Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. It's time for TWiT's annual audience survey, and we want to hear from you. Please visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It only takes a few minutes, and your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. We thank you so much for your continued support. twit.tv/survey. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, April 5th, 2015. This is episode 1176. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by SmartThings. SmartThings lets you monitor, control, and automate your home from wherever you are using your smartphone. Right now, SmartThings is offering the Tech Guy listeners 10% off any home security or solution kit. And get free shipping in the U.S. when you go to smartthings.com/twit and use the offer code TWIT at checkout. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, all that jazz. And whether 'tis better to eat the tail or the ears of the bunny first. All of that. Are you a chocolate bunny? Of course it's a chocolate. I'm not talking regular. Chocolate bunny. Do you eat the ears? Or do you snarf the tail first?
I think you start at the top.
Start at the top, work your way down.
Yeah.
Isn't that a song? We started at the top, now we're here. No, that's wrong. Mostly things with chips in them. I'm talking about digital stuff. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my phone number if you want to call me. And we'll talk. 888-827-5536. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. We take Skype calls from all around the world, though, to that number. 8888-ASK-LEO. We also have a website where you can find everything I talk about. You don't have to write anything down. Chat room's there. Everything after the show, we put audio and video. You can put your comments. We'd love to hear from you. And all of that's free and open, and there's no sign-up. Just go to techguylabs.com. That's all you really have to remember, techguylabs.com. Happy birthday, Microsoft. 40 years old this week. And going through a midlife crisis, I think it's safe to say. Midlife crisis could be good, could be bad. April 4th, yesterday, was the 40th birthday of Microsoft becoming a company, a corporation. It's kind of amazing. Originally founded by old friends, high school friends, Bill Gates, who was a student at Harvard, his buddy Paul Allen, a couple of years ahead of him. He called Paul after seeing a microcomputer, I think it was a MITS Altair, on the cover of Popular Mechanics, and called Paul, and they had already done some software together in high school. They'd had a little company called Trafo Data that analyzed, you know those little rubber tubes they put across the street? That was Bill Gates' first company. Analyzed the data that came from those rubber tubes as cars passed over him. In high school, they had a company doing that. Bill saw the coming computer revolution in 1975, and he said, wow, something's happening here. Called his buddy Paul and said, we ought to start a company. And you know what we ought to do? We ought to make software for these computers. He said, the computer revolution is going to come down to two things. It's going to come down to chips, processors, and the software that runs on it. And he said, I want to do the software that runs on it. April 4th, 1975, Bill Gates and Paul Allen formed the company with the worst name ever, Microsoft. Didn't matter now, but at the time, imagine. They were going to develop BASIC, the basic computer language, BASIC interpreters for the MITS Altair. And they started in Albuquerque because that's across the street from where MITS was, the company that made this kit computer, but eventually decided to move to the tax-free haven of Washington State where he had grown up, where Bill had grown up. And by 1981, they were a well-known software company. IBM came to them and said, hey, ixnay, don't tell anybody, but we're going to, you know, this Apple computer thing that's everybody's buying Apple II computers? We're going to make one, a personal computer. And now IBM was the big computer company, right? But they only made mainframes, big iron that millions of dollars only companies, big companies could afford. We're going to make a small computer desktop. But we need, see, this is Bill Gates' insight was right, software. You can't do anything with a chip unless you have a program on it. In fact, what we need is something called an operating system, something that lets other people write programs that run on it. You wouldn't happen to have an operating system lying around, would you? And Bill, who was a cagey guy, cagey fella, said, yeah, sure. Then ran across the street to a little company called Seattle DOS and said, didn't mention IBM, we'd like to license your operating system. We'd like to borrow your operating system. Didn't mention that maybe that it would have some value beyond what they were talking about. IBM licensed it from them. And Bill Gates pulled a second very sharp trick. He didn't give them an exclusive license to what became MS-DOS. IBM called it PC-DOS. He said, IBM, I'll sell you copies, you know, for royalty of PC-DOS, but we want to keep a hold of it if somebody else might want to buy it. And IBM thought, well, who else would want to buy that? And said, ah, yeah, sure, kid. That was a little bit of a mistake because it turned out that IBM, as it made its computer, was working so fast, they didn't keep it a secret how they were doing it. When it was released, they didn't copyright or patent or anything the BIOS. And so clone makers immediately popped up like Compaq Computer, and they needed an operating system. And lo and behold, there was Bill Gates and Microsoft and the same DOS that IBM was using on their PC. Well, why not? We'll call it MS, Microsoft DOS. And an empire was born. An empire was born. Actually, IBM did copyright the PC BIOS. I'm wrong, actually. But what happened was the companies were able to reverse engineer it, and nothing else was copyrighted. So companies went into sterile rooms, and they figured out how BIOS worked, the key software on the IBM PC, duplicated that, and the rest of it was just regular parts anybody could get. And then MS-DOS was available. In 1986, Microsoft went public, and I think that was pretty successful. Three billionaires created almost instantly, Bill Gates, Paul Allen, and Steve Ballmer, Gates' college friend from Harvard, who became the head of sales there. Microsoft's done fairly well for itself. Bill Gates became, for a long time, the richest man in the world, thanks to his large stake in Microsoft. And if it weren't for Microsoft and Microsoft DOS and then later Windows and the stability it gave programmers, the knowledge that, hey, if we write this program to run on Microsoft DOS or Microsoft Windows, it'll run on all these computers, hundreds of companies making personal computers, and it'll work on all of them. And if it hadn't been for Microsoft, we wouldn't have had the PC revolution. Thousands of programs doing all sorts of things, a revolution powered by Microsoft. Lots of credit to them. But the world has changed. Bill Gates retired. Steve Ballmer took his place. He's retired. Satya Nadella now runs Microsoft, and as I said, it's in its middle age in its 40th year. Now it's 41st year. It's a very different company, and in fact, the crown jewel of Microsoft, their software, Microsoft Windows and Microsoft Office, are less important, aren't they? In a cloud based world. Microsoft has its own cloud, and it's trying to find its way in this new world of tablets, mobile. Hasn't done well in mobile, has it, with Windows Phone? And and operating systems are less important. But I have a feeling Microsoft has a pretty good strategy going forward. I feel fairly bullish for the future of this computer industry pioneer. Microsoft, happy birthday. Happy 40th birthday. Do you remember your first Microsoft product? I think for me it was probably MS-DOS 3.3. What was it that came on the first? I had a, didn't have an IBM PC, but I had one of the early clones, I think. 1982 maybe. Was it an Eagle? I think it was called an Eagle computer. Probably MS-DOS 3.3. What was your first Microsoft product? We'll get a little cake and celebrate. Blow out the 40 candles. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Your call's next. Beautiful day wherever you are. I hope you're enjoying a lovely day. And I'm glad you decided to spend some of it with me, the tech guy, Leo Laporte. 8888 Ask Leo. Heather Hammond is also here in a lovely Easter green. You look like not an Easter egg. You just look, that's beautiful though.
That's what I was going for. Last year I was a carrot. Today I'm a teal egg.
Teal egg. And I am a chocolate bunny. So there you go. She looked at me. She said, why aren't you wearing pastels? I don't look good in pastels. That is not my...
I was like, get over here. I'm going to put a yellow bow tie on you.
No. Well, I should have worn a yellow bow tie. I didn't think... I'm wearing... This bow tie has shades of yellow, but it's mostly brown.
You're a chocolate Easter bunny.
I'm a chocolate Easter bunny. I don't mind that. Just don't bite my ears off, and chocolate. I'm okay. So you've been lining up the calls, I think.
Yes, I have.
And I would guess that by now you've found somebody to talk to.
Oh, for sure. Tech never takes a holiday, so we're going to talk to Jeff in Burbank.
Hey, Jeff, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thanks, Heather.
Hey, Leo. It's Jeff Stanfield again. I called you last week or the week before. And I have a project that I'm trying to do and a little bit of an issue with it. I have a client who has an RV, and him and his wife are trucking down the roads visiting all the states, and they want to take all their technology with them. They have their Mac Mini and their iPads. They have a big TV, which has, you know, internet technology. They have DVR. They have the Apple TV. And the problem is that if they want to, like, sync it all together, they have to sync it to, like, a router. So they have an Apple Airport Express, but the Apple Airport Express needs to connect to a hardwired router in order for it to sync all the devices together. And I'm looking at other routers and trying to find something that can sync all these devices together.
I think you got that wrong, so let's stop right there.
Okay.
So the Airport Express is a Wi-Fi access spot. If it will become a router. It is a router if you plug it into the internet. You don't need another router. You have a router.
But it wouldn't work because I actually called. I went and talked to the Apple stores. I went and talked to the Apple technicians. And I went and talked to my fellow ACN buddies, and they're all like, no, you have to have it. It has to, the Apple one has to be connected to, and I called Linksys.
That's not true. I don't know why they're all saying that. All you have to do is connect it to the internet, and it's a router. But I do it all the time. They're wrong. I don't know what they're saying.
But
the problem you have is you have no internet. You're in an RV.
Right. So
you want to make what's called an ad hoc network. That's a Wi-Fi network without internet access. And then you'll all be networked together. It's called an ad hoc network. The Airport Express will do an ad hoc network. I'm surprised that all these so-called geniuses don't understand this. I mean, they're baffled because what you're doing is not what anybody does because everybody hooks it up to the internet. So unless there's some magical thing that an Airport Express can't do an ad hoc network, but that was, you don't even need an Airport Express. Frankly, you could do the ad hoc network with your laptop.
Yeah, I guess I could. But they can't. All these devices can't link to the. I couldn't get them to link to the laptop. I tried that as well, and I mean the Airport Express. Because I don't have to do pro video stuff. I don't do the home installation stuff.
So go on your laptop, go on your MacBook, and you're going to create an ad hoc network. So there's two kinds of Wi-Fi networks. There's one called an infrastructure, which is the normal way you would think of it. You take the Airport Express or any computer and plug it hardwired into the internet, which could be a cable modem, a DSL modem, you know, whatever device gives you the internet. Mostly RVers will tend to use satellite internet. So you'd have a satellite internet box. You plug it into that. And now that, it can set up an ad hoc Wi-Fi network, and the Wi-Fi will actually have internet access. You don't need a router. Your computer is a router. So I don't really understand where the issue is. Just maybe if you now know what you need to do, you can do it. You set up what's called an ad hoc network. And that is just basically a Wi-Fi network without any internet access or internet access from another source. But you don't even get an Airport Express. You don't need one. That's a Wi-Fi access spot. So all you need to do is now what you might want to do is then get perhaps a better choice would be to go out and so go to one of your whoever is the best cell carrier in the places your friends go to and get a MiFi. Get a like Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile. They all sell little kind of credit card, Virgin Mobile, little kind of credit card sized devices that are actually Wi-Fi access points. They handle up to 5 devices in most cases. That might be an issue for you. I don't know if you have more than 5 devices, but they'll handle up to 5 devices. And then they actually get internet through 4G or 3G. If they're not getting internet, though, they still could do an ad hoc network. But the thing is, you have what you need. You don't even need to buy anything. Anyone, your iPhone could do an ad hoc network. Your MacBook can do an ad hoc network. The key is that you have to set up a network. And I don't know. I can't understand why there was any difficulty. The people you talked to must have misunderstood what you wanted to do because it's very easy to do. Walter is in Holland. Hi, Walter.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Is it okay to call it Holland, or should I say the Netherlands?
Actually, it is the Netherlands, but Holland is fine to me.
Here in America, we call Switzerland, Switzerland. We call Holland, Holland, even though neither of those names... I'm sounding like Alex Trebek. Neither of those names are actually the names the countries use for themselves. What can I do for you in the Netherlands? Where are you in the Netherlands?
I have been using my MacBook Pro Retina 2012.
Yes, me too. That's
for a little while now, and yes. I really love it.
Yes.
Bought it secondhand.
Okay.
But there's a problem. If I look really close to it, especially on dark backgrounds, I see all kinds of red, blue, white pixels.
You have the problem that so many people with mid-2012 MacBook Pros have been complaining about. Apple ignored them, ignored them, ignored them, and finally last month said, okay, yes, there is a problem with the video. So here's what you do. You go under the Apple menu. There is an About This Mac. That'll open up a dialog box. And at the very end, there's a service button. This is if you're using Mavericks or Yosemite, which I'm sure you are by now. There's a service button, and it'll say, check the serial number and tell me if there's any coverage. Check my service and support coverage status. You don't even need to give it a serial number. It will automatically check your serial number. And then say, let's see, yes, there's a recall. Because I think that's what you're seeing here is this is sounds exactly like the video problem people have been having with mid-2012 MacBook Pros. And if your serial number is in the recall, they'll fix it for you for free, even though it's out of date.
So the strange thing is, though, when I hook it up to an external monitor, which I have right now, there is no problem on the external monitor, not at all.
Well, it could then be something else. I mean, it could be first I would do this just to make sure. But the fact that the external monitor isn't bugged maybe means that there's a short in the ribbon cable. This is very common in laptops that goes to the screen that's causing weirdness. Or maybe the screen itself is shot, an LCD screen. That might be exactly what it would look like if there were problems. In either case, those would need repairs of the laptop. But first thing I do is check the serial number. Might solve the whole thing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by SmartThings. Oh, let's talk about SmartThings. SmartThings.com. This was a Kickstarter project. I forgot when they did it. A few years ago. They raised enough money to create the SmartThings Hub. And what a revolution the SmartThings Hub has been for home automation. You know the problem with home automation. You can't... everything has its own protocol. You can't... There's no one way to talk to everything in your house. I have Hue lights. I have Sonos. I have a Nest thermostat. This talks to everything. Honeywell, Schlage locks, even like, notice, like your jawbone. So the hub means you use one app, the SmartThings app, to control everything in your house, which means you've got some power here. You start with one of the great SmartThings kits. They have security and solution kits that'll help you get started. And then you can add, they have many of their own little doohickeys, the smart power outlet, the smart sense motion. But you can also talk to SmartThings devices and other devices. And that's really what's so cool about SmartThings. Smart enough to have won the CES 2015 Editor's Choice Award, and rightly so. This is just a fantastic product. Imagine, and you see, by the way, they have apps for Android, iOS, and Windows Phone. Isn't that nice? Imagine clicking good night on your phone, and it turns off the lights, it locks the doors, checks the garage door. I do that by hand now. SmartThings can automate that whole process. If you would love a smart house, try SmartThings right now. We've got a special deal for you, 10% off any home security or solution kit, and free shipping in the U.S., but you've got to go to smartthings.com/twit, smartthings.com/twit. Use the offer code TWIT, and you get 10% off. smartthings.com/twit. Use the offer code TWIT. It is really, really sweet. And by the way, more stuff being added all the time to the SmartThings hubs, which is really great. I like being a part of the SmartThings community. You will too. smartthings.com/twit. Remember, free apps, no monthly fees, and 10% off when you use the offer code TWIT. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. Sandra in Stepford, Indiana. There's actually a town called Stepford.
Bedford.
Wow. Like as in wives. Hello?
No. Bedford.
Oh, Bedford. Oh, okay. So Heather heard Stepford. That tells you a little something about her psychology.
That's funny.
In beautiful Bedford, Indiana. Hi. Hi, Sandra.
Well, we are all in step here. So.
What can I do for you?
Well, okay. I have friends who think I'm real good at computers, which I'm not really, but I know a little more than they do.
Never, never admit ignorance. That's
I know.
Geek
they,
way.
They think I'm really smart. But anyway, so one's in Florida, one maybe in another town in Indiana, and they're wanting me to help them. And I'm really not an IE tech that can do much over the telephone.
Yeah, you need, and this is why remote access is really big in tech support.
Well, I hadn't thought about that, but
do you feel like if you could, in your home, look at their machine, actually be using their machine, you could solve their problems?
I might be able to, but I don't know if I want to.
There's the risk of it. As soon as you show them that you can do that, you'll never hear the end of it.
I know, and I'll be on the phone for hours.
I do that with my mom. I go into her computer and I use GoToAssist.
I'm probably about the age of your mom.
Yeah, I use GoToAssist, and I go into her computer, and she says things like, "Oh, I just love watching you move the mouse around." okay, so that's one possibility. What's your question?
Well,
I guess I should ask.
My question is there somewhere that I can direct them to on the internet where they can go into very basic, little lessons or tutorials?
Oh yes, there are some really good tutorial sites. I'll start with the Elder Geek, which I love. They're Windows users.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Windows one's got a Google Chromebook, which I don't think I'd want one of them. But
oh, I love the Chromebook. I'm a Chromebook fanatic.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. The nice thing is that one won't need much help.
Well, I don't know.
She can't get in much trouble. It's basically just the Chrome browser.
I know, but I can't. I have really a hard time getting through to her to what she needs to do. And I don't know if she can be helped, tell you the truth. But
Yeah. Because really, you understand enough to do that one because it's just the browser. So she's saying, well, how do I find something?
Well, her problem was that she was with Comcast and she isn't anymore. And she says that keeps coming up and won't let her go anywhere.
Oh, yeah. She probably has a router that still thinks it's on Comcast.
Well, she's even moved to a different
town.
Oh, you know what?
She probably was doing. She was probably borrowing the neighbor's Comcast.
I don't know. It's like
I've heard of people doing that and not knowing.
She can get past it, but I helped her create a new Gmail the other day. So I told her you can get past it.
Yeah, she's getting past it if she was able to get it.
But I don't know how to explain it to her. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And So you say Elder Geek.
Elder Geek is wonderful. And don't take, tell them not to take it personally. It's not just for old folk. It's just the name of the site, but it's a great tutorial site.
Okay.
There's also, if they get more sophisticated, there's How To Geek.
How To Geek?
Yeah, I think that's, okay. Let me just look this up, make sure I got the name right. Because I frequently refer people, in fact, the chat, yeah, it's the How To Geek. So there's the Elder Geek and How To Geek. And both of these are tutorial sites. Elder Geek is simpler and more straightforward. How To Geek is maybe a little bit more advanced.
Well, you know, some people don't even know how to cut and paste.
There are also really good books, and it might be a place for them. You know, one of the things you need to understand is how they learn. Some people need to hear you talk it. Some people need to have you show it. Mm-hmm. Some people want to read it. And so if people are comfortable with reading, there are some excellent books designed for exactly for your friends, for people who are new to computing and want it to be pretty straightforward and easy to understand. Pearson has this, or is it O'Reilly? I think it's O'Reilly has a series. Let me see if I can find the name of it. It was a really good, was it Head First? No, wasn't Head First is good for some stuff.
I didn't understand what you said.
Yeah, there's a, I'm just trying to remember. My old publisher, Pearson, has computer books for novices. And
okay.
I'm trying to remember the name. Oh, yeah, The Absolute Beginner's Guides. So the very first one would be The Absolute Beginner's Guides to Computer Basics. And what's, you don't have to tell them this, but there's lots of big pictures.
Oh, I'll tell them.
it's a really, it's a good series. The Absolute Beginner's Guides. Don't get the Dummies Guides. I actually don't think they're all that good. The Absolute Beginner's Guides are fantastic.
Okay, great.
Community college, their local community college will have classes if they're the kind of people that need to kind of have somebody show them.
They probably wouldn't do that.
Yeah. I would say the Chromebook is going to be the easiest one. The reason is she sees her old login probably.
I know, and that's what
Here's what you could do. The nice thing about Chromebooks, and this is one of the reasons I recommend them, in the settings, so she'll click in the right-hand corner and then click settings. And in the settings, there's an advanced. At the bottom, it says advanced. Click that. There's at the very bottom of that, there's something called a power wash. And if your friend ever gets like, I've messed this thing up, you power wash it. It goes back to the way it came from the factory. And then it won't remember Comcast or anything.
If I can get her there, that's the problem.
And then the beauty of this is in order to use a Chromebook, you do have to have a Google account. That's going to be her login. But the beauty of it is you already have created that.
She's got that already.
All you have to do is know her Google login. You could do a power wash. She does the Google login at the beginning. It remembers all her settings. Everything's brought in fresh. You won't see Comcast anymore. You'll see whatever her current internet provider is.
I can't do that for her, though. She has to do that.
She has to do it.
Computer.
She
right.
has to do it. But you can walk her through it. I'll give you some tips now from the other side. I'll give you a couple of tips because I often am doing this. I'm doing this all the time, right?
Okay.
So the first thing is you have to close your eyes and visualize, and you have to know the computer well enough to visualize it. If you don't have a Chromebook, this is going to be a little tough because you have to know to say things like, "Okay, go move your mouse to the lower right hand corner. See where the time is? Click that.
Click on the time or near there.
Yeah, it's actually the time would work, and you'll get a pop up." Maybe just to the right of the time, and you'll get a pop-up that's one of the things is settings, and then you click that. The other thing to do is let me think about some of the tips I would give people. It's important to understand how people learn. It's very tempting, and it's very easy to get frustrated by saying, click this, click this, click this.
Well, they want me to do it for them.
They do, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Yes, but you're not there.
No, and I don't, I don't want to be on the phone for an hour for one thing.
Yeah. Let's see. What other tips? Tell them other ways they can find out, like Elder Geek. The Elder Geek is great.
Right. I got that written down.
But they have to be comfortable kind of reading. It's like a book, reading online. I really do think the Head First. I mean, the Absolute Beginner's Guides are great.
Okay.
What else? What other tricks do I learn? I mostly just to count to 10. My wife taught me that because I talk to my mom and I start to steam starts to come out of my ears and I turn bright.
Your wife taught you why? I didn't understand.
Count to 10.
Oh, count to 10.
She says, before you respond, count to 10. Just breathe.
Yeah.
And then the other thing she told me, this won't help you at all, is just remember your mother changed your diapers for the first 3 years.
Ew.
And then I'll go, okay, you're right. At least I can help her for a little bit.
You don't want to go there.
No, I don't want to go. It is really challenging, isn't it, to help somebody with their computer problems, especially over the phone. Keep listening to the show. Tell them to listen to this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I love the music we're playing today. Thank you, Mr. Nathan Staten, musical director. If you've seen Whiplash yet, he's just like J.K. Simmons in Whiplash. He's just harsh, mean, tough. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. I'd love if many of the people listening to the show are the tech support for their family and friends. If you're in the business of amateur tech support or even professional tech support, I'd love to hear your suggestions for dealing. There's a great video, some kind of paparazzi video of the musician John Mayer. He's outside. I guess it's the rehearsal for his show that night, and he's outside on the stage door, and he's talking to his dad. I'll have to see if I can find this. It's very funny because it's a conversation we've all had. He says, okay, click the Apple menu. Okay, click no the Apple no dad. It's in the upper left hand the Apple menu. And he's saying things like, wait, you can do this, Dad. You can do this. We've all been there. We've all been there. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. John in La Cañada, California. Hi, John.
Hi. I'd like to get your idea of what is a software container?
Heather tells me you read an article in the Washington Post about software containers. It's a hot topic right now in enterprise, in business computing. And so that's why the Post is writing about it. And a lot of investors are very hot about it. The best known software container is something called Docker.
That's the company they talk about.
Yeah. Docker's really cool. So you can kind of think of it as a kind of virtual machine. Now, I know for most people they go, oh, that helps. Oh, a container is a virtual machine. Yeah, kind of. What the idea is that perhaps you've had some experience if you're a Mac user running Windows on a Macintosh, or if you're a Windows user using something called VMware to run a different operating system kind of inside your operating system.
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah, it's a virtual machine. A container is almost identical to a virtual. It's a little bit different.
But why do I want to get smart about it?
Well, you would only if you were run a CIO or an IT manager. You don't need it as a home user. You don't need to know anything about container technology. It's cool because it's used heavily in servers, in the web. For instance, nowadays, if you get a website of your own, you're probably running inside a container many containers on a single machine. That kind of thing. It isn't something you as an end user ever need to know about.
Okay. It's the Wall Street Journal, by the way.
Oh, yeah, the Wall Street Journal. Well, see, that's because investors are interested in this because it's, you know, they're always looking for what's the hot technology today.
Yeah, software firms scramble to jump into containers.
Yeah. Well, and Docker is the one that got all the attention. The funny thing is it's open source. So it's free and widely available, and that's one of the reasons enterprise loves it, is although there are companies making money on it. It's nothing anybody normal needs to worry about.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Wall Street Journal. Okay. Get interested in containers. It's like, it's probably a year ago, it was get interested in software as a service. And then they don't even say software as a service. They say SaaS, S-A-A-S. It's that kind of, you know, enterprise business-based computing that you don't need to know about. You really don't. I mean, I'm fascinated by it. Microsoft has jumped onto Docker. They offer Docker containers in their Azure cloud. It's a cloud thing. We're all very interested in the cloud. You know, I started talking about how this is the 40th anniversary of Microsoft, and the world changed underneath Microsoft. And maybe if I explain it this way, it'll all make sense to you. You probably are familiar with, and probably in your mind have this mental model of computing that involves a thing, was on your desk, maybe your lap, now in your pocket, but a thing that has a processor, has some storage, has some memory, random access memory. You can type into it. You can buy software for it. You put it on there and it runs. That model of computing was what Microsoft popularized and Microsoft Windows made possible. The computer on your desktop running an operating system that allowed you to buy a wide variety of well-designed, inexpensive software to run on it. That transformed the world in the 80s and the 90s. But Microsoft's been struggling lately because guess what? The world transformed further after that. And where we're seeing it is things like the Chromebook, where you no longer really, your computer is kind of extended. It began with the internet. It began with connecting your computer to networks all over the world. Now, at first, it was just a conversation. You go to a website and you see some stuff, you read some stuff, you send some email. But what you didn't know or maybe weren't thinking about is each time you went to a website, you were actually visiting another computer. And that computer, the web server, was doing some work to show you that page. It was sending the contents of the page down to your computer, and your computer would, in its browser, draw it on the screen so you could see it. But you were, in effect, talking to another computer. Well, over time, what those computers were doing has gotten more sophisticated. Started really, I think the first time most of us used what we call now a web app or web application was Gmail. Google Mail, more than 10 years old now. 10 years ago, people started en masse using Google's mail server to access their email. The email wasn't on your computer. It was on some other computer out there. And in fact, Gmail itself was doing a lot of work on that computer out there to display your email, to sort your email, even to show it to you on your screen. It was a web application, and a lot of software was running on that other computer owned by Google. You just weren't aware of it. To you, it looked just like a web page. In fact, there was software also running on your computer you may not have been aware of, some JavaScript running at the same time to render it. So what happened is the CPU, the processor that was on your desktop, has started to kind of distribute itself out into the internet. And more, the software you're running is not running on your computer. It's running over the internet. If you use Microsoft's web-based version of Office, it looks just like Word and Excel and PowerPoint, except that much of the work is being done on Microsoft's servers. The software itself, the copy of Word that you're using, is running not on your computer, but on Microsoft's servers. So this is challenging for Microsoft because it turns out you just need a browser. You don't need Microsoft Windows to run Microsoft Office in the cloud. You just need a browser. And that's why the Chromebook is such a revolution, because the Chromebook is just a browser. But it's running software that's out there, software as a service that's out there. And it means that you don't need anymore. You don't need Microsoft Windows. And that's what's starting to happen to Microsoft, is their business has changed dramatically. Here you have a company that was built around the concept of providing software for computers. But the computers don't need your software anymore. It makes it very difficult. And the kind of software they need is not the kind of software Microsoft sells. It's software that's running on the out there in the cloud. So one of the reasons people like the Wall Street Journal write about containers and Docker and things like that is because these are new cloud technologies. And even investors and people, the staid old folks at the Wall Street Journal, are starting to realize that just as people made a lot of money buying Microsoft stock, buying Apple stock, buying computer companies and software companies, the future really isn't with computer companies per se, or even desktop software companies, but with cloud companies and cloud computing. But we don't know who's going to be the winner or who's going to be the loser. So that's why you'll see a lot of kind of pumped up articles in the Wall Street Journal about the next big thing. Everybody's trying to, what's the next big thing? We kind of missed, I think many people, including Microsoft, missed the boat on smartphones, how important those are going to be. That's really the hardware you use. But a smartphone really doesn't exist without internet access. Try and use it without internet access. It's not such a smartphone because much of what's going on is running in the cloud. In fact, when the Apple iPhone first came out, they didn't think you'd be running apps. They thought you'd be running web apps. They didn't think they'd had to put applications on the phone. They thought you'd just be running applications on the cloud. And it turned out people wanted local applications. Gaming and things like that do best when they're local. 8888-ASKLEY, a long explanation, but a little bit of computer history. And the world is changing. And then that's why it's so interesting to watch companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft and Facebook try to keep up. Times change awfully rapidly now. I'm trying to keep up too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Well, hey, hey, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, home theater. Camcorders? Really? No. GPS devices. Let's do a whole thing on fax machines, standalone GPS devices for your car. MP3 players. It's amazing how fast technology goes out of date. I'll talk about anything with a chip in it. 8888 Ask Leo, our digital photography gurus. Chris Marquardt joins us in about half an hour to talk digital photography. A little myth busting. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Ed is in 29 Palms. Nice place to be this time of year. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well, and it's a nice place to be this time of year. I have a question. I know you can help me. I have a nice little Dell Inspiron laptop, and I've got it connected to my local provider by way of the modem. And I would like to transfer the image I'm looking at on the laptop to my 40-inch monitor. It's an older Sony, but it still works very well. I don't know what to do.
You can hardwire it. Does your laptop have an HDMI connector?
Yes, it does.
And does the TV have it may be out of date if it doesn't have an HDMI connector.
It's got one.
Good.
And I tried to put something in it, but I don't think I did it right.
You need an HDMI cable. I don't know what something is that you put in there.
Well, it is an HDMI cable.
Oh, good.
I guess I said that very...
Yeah, yeah, putting a piece of bacon in there will not help, but an HDMI cable would work, and then you put that under your computer.
Right.
You may need to go into the computer's display settings and tell it to mirror what's on the screen out the HDMI port, and then it will show up on your TV. That's the easiest and best way to do it because the TV basically becomes a second monitor.
Right, right. Okay. I didn't even think it was going into the settings.
You have to make sure that it's sending it out. Okay. There may be also laptops, Dells particularly, have keys to do that because they're often used in a situation where you're presenting on PowerPoint, right? And you plug in a projector and then there are keys on the keyboard that say, hey, send it out to the projector. So if you look at your manual or you look it up online, I don't know which key it is because it varies from keyboard to keyboard, but you may even see a special little icon on one of the function keys. But if you go into displays, the display settings, you should be able to. There's two choices with dual monitors. You can either extend the existing display, which means you now have double the landscape. You know, and you could drag something from one window to the other. Usually for what you want to do mirroring. So there's extend the monitor or mirror the monitor, and mirror sounds like what it is, which is duplicate what I see on my laptop screen, on my big screen.
Okay, and when I do this, will it be necessary to keep the laptop open, or can I close?
Yeah, because the laptop's, yeah.
I mean, not open, I mean, not on, but I mean...
Well, it depends. Some laptops know, like Apple laptops, are designed to continue displaying when you close the laptop. Most Windows laptops do not.
Okay.
So you try it, but what will probably happen is the machine will go to sleep. When you close the machine, it usually just goes to sleep, and so does your TV.
So just go into displays, and that should help.
Yep. So they're telling me Windows P will work if you're using a late version of Windows.
Okay.
But anyway, I think that's all it is. Now, there are other wireless ways to do it. There's wireless display, which is an Intel technology. Your Dell probably supports that. Your TV probably doesn't. But you could get a dongle that would do it. But since you have HDMI, that's always the best way to do it. It's the fastest. The only thing bad about it, of course, is you're cabled in to the TV. You will see immediately, though, and a lot of, I get calls this almost every week. I get somebody saying, I want to use my big screen TV for a computer monitor. And you'll see immediately why I don't recommend this, because ironically, a computer monitor is a higher quality display than your HD TV. And that's because you sit closer to a computer monitor than you do to your TV. So your TV is actually pretty low resolution. A 55-inch 1080p screen is a very small dot per inch, because it doesn't need more than that. On the other hand, your computer monitor, which you're sitting an arm's length away from, or sometimes even closer, will have a much higher dot per inch and look much better. And why does the dots per inch matter? Well, if you don't have at least 100 or more dots per inch, text won't show up very well. And now, increasingly, we're getting used to even higher dot pitch, things like 300 dots per inch. The newest Samsung Galaxy S6, which is coming out this week, will probably, I believe, have the largest screen resolution, the highest dots per inch of any screen ever, at 577 dots per inch. That's well beyond the ability of the human eye to tell the difference. But you'll see on a TV, it doesn't look good. GM Bob is making a point, which is probably a good one, which is, if you've changed the settings on your computer and the TV doesn't adjust, it's sometimes the TV has to go out and look at the cable and figure it out. So it might do to unplug the HDMI port on the TV, unplug from the TV and plug it back in again. That's kind of a signal to the TV. Hey, look, I'm sending you a signal. Would you look at this and see if you can display it? The TV does have to be able to display it. So you may have to change your resolution on your computer because, again, the computer's used to something much higher resolution than your HD TV. Donna in T.O., Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Donna.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for talking to me today.
My pleasure.
I'm in no way computer savvy, but I am pretty tenacious and I try to figure things out.
That's really all you need is patience and tenacity.
I'm kind of at a loss right now.
Okay.
I've got a MacBook Pro 2011, and I do use it for business, but just very minor business. I have a QuickBooks program that I use.
Yeah.
And what I usually do is I leave my computer on so I'm not turning it off and relaunching everything. So I usually have my Safari and my mail on, my QuickBooks. And then I also have the Time Machine backup and the Carbonite.
You are my favorite person. There's nothing that could go wrong that you can't handle.
Well, I also have Dropbox. So I'm just because I don't lose my business information.
Yeah, no, I love Dropbox. No, Dropbox is great. Good. You're set.
In the morning, whenever I come to my computer and I turn it on, wake it up, I don't turn it off. I just wake it up.
Okay.
It takes probably about 10 minutes for me to get any information.
Oh.
I go to Safari.
Hold on a second, because that's not right. Hold on a second. We have to take a break.
Oh, okay.
But that is not right, and we're gonna get to the bottom of this.
Thank you. Especially
on a Mac, when you wake it up, it should be ready to use within seconds. So there's something going on, and we're going to figure out what it is. We'll do a little computer diagnostics.
Thank you,
Donna. Hang on the line. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We're going to talk high tech for another hour or so, so give me a ring. Hey, our show today, I should mention, by the way, our show today brought to you by Gazelle. And this is a good thing because, the Galaxy S6 is coming out. I'm getting mine Tuesday. Maybe you've decided you don't like the iPhone 5 anymore. You want a 6, or maybe you've got a 6 and you want a 6 Plus. Gazelle's the place to go to trade in your old gadgets, get cash, so you can buy a new one. Actually, they buy and sell now, which is really cool. G-A-Z-E-L-L-E, gazelle.com. So you can go to gazelle.com right now and get a quote for your old iPad, your old BlackBerry, your HTC, LG, Motorola, Nokia, or Samsung phone, your iPad, a tablet from Google or Microsoft or Samsung or Asus or Amazon. They'll pay you cash on the barrel head. But what's nice is you have 30 days to take advantage of it. So get that quote now. It's good for 30 days. Then decide if you want the new phone. Thing is, the quote is locked in and it's not going to go up. So get the quote as fast as you can and pile in all the other gadgets you've got. Once you decide you want to take advantage of Gazelle's offer, Just check out. They'll send you a box, prepaid postage and everything. They pay the postage on anything worth more than a buck. Ship it to Gazelle. Their experts will wipe the data if you forget to. They even buy broken iPhones and iPads. Then they'll send you a check, a PayPal credit, or an Amazon gift card. They bump the value of the Amazon gift card by 5%. In fact, sometimes they'll bump the value quoted to you even. We've had that happen where I'll send them something and they say, no, it's worth more than we thought. And they'll give you more money. I never heard of a company doing that. No wonder 9 out of every 10 Gazelle customers rate their experience excellent. 2 million plus trade-ins, $200 million in cash paid out. And you may say, well, what happens to that stuff I sell? Well, the very best of it, they will sell back in their buy certified program. So if you lose your phone or you break it, you can get an excellent replacement. Devices from Gazelle.com are available in two conditions, certified like new and certified good. Now, the good maybe have some gentle signs of wear, but it's going to work perfectly. That's because all devices have been put through Gazelle's rigorous 30-point inspection, so they're fully functional. Plus, you get 30 days with risk-free returns. So a great place to save a lot of money on a new device, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E, Gazelle.com. Get that quote today. It's good for 30 days. Oh, and we thank Gazelle for their support of our podcast. I think Nathan Staten's in a good weather mood. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. We were talking to Donna, who has a sleepy Macintosh. She puts it to sleep at night, and it takes 10 minutes to wake up in the morning. That's a sleepy head. So, Donna, let me ask you a couple of questions.
Yes.
Do you have any external drives hooked up to that Macintosh?
Would that be like my Time Machine or my printer?
Yeah, USB drive. Yeah. Printer, maybe, but mostly a USB drive. Your Time Machine's hooked up to it?
Yes.
So one thing to test is eject that Time Machine drive.
Okay.
And disconnect it. And then see if it has trouble waking up. If it does, who made the drive you're using?
I don't know.
Okay. Doesn't really matter.
Not really sure.
Sometimes external hard drives take a while to spin up, and your Mac may not want to wake up until everything's awake.
Okay.
So that's one problem that can happen. There's also something that the newer Macintoshes have. Which operating system are you using now? Mavericks?
The latest.
You've gone to Yosemite.
Yes, I'm on Yosemite.
Yosemite.
Right.
So there's something called Safe Sleep.
Okay.
Which is a deeper sleep. I'm going to read you what Apple says. For Mac computers that are started from a mechanical hard drive, that's like yours, right? Your internal mm-hmm. drive. OS X includes a deep sleep mode known as safe sleep. Your Mac may enter safe sleep if your battery begins to run low or, and I think this might be what's happening, your computer is left idle for a long time. Now, normally overnight is not long enough. We're talking days. But what it is, and PC users will be familiar with this, what it's known as is hibernate mode. And what it does is it copies the memory in your RAM to the hard disk and shuts everything down. Then when you lift the lid or you turn your Mac on, it's reloading memory from the hard drive. And sometimes it takes a while to get going. Mm-hmm. We don't like hibernate mode in general. I like to turn that off if possible. So I don't know if there's a way to disable hibernating. I don't think there is in the energy saver.
Generally, when it does this, it's just overnight. And so what I'll do is I'll come in and I'll think, oh, okay, let's check my mail. And it'll be spinning and won't let me. Okay, I'll take a look at Safari. Oop, can't do that either. Okay,
yeah.
Let's go ahead.
So what's happening is the beach ball is spinning for a long time.
Yes, the computer itself turns right on.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know if I should be closing down every window or completely shutting it off.
Beach balling is a common problem on the Macintosh. And it's, frankly, I think it's a bug. And it's a known bug, especially in Yosemite. So there's a couple of things you can try here. The first thing I would do is go into the energy saver and turn off power nap. So the idea of power nap is even while the lid is closed and the computer is asleep, it will go out and back up on Time Machine. It'll get mail. It'll do updates. That can cause it to slow down during wake up. So I would disable power nap. You might also see a checkbox that says, put hard drive to sleep. Don't put your hard drive to sleep. See if this fixes it. If it doesn't, you may have a larger problem. And I've had this problem, and the way I find it is by using a program that's hidden away on the Macintosh in the utility applications utility disk. It is a process monitor, I think they call it activity monitor. Yeah, they do. And what activity monitor does is takes a look at what programs are running. Next time you go to bed, start activity monitor before you go to sleep and just let it run during the night. And what you're going to want to look at, there's a CPU tab. You're going to want to see if anything is using a lot, like 100% of your CPU. There are two tasks on the Macintosh operating system that can go wild. And I've had this happen on my Mac Pro. You wouldn't think a Mac Pro would slow down, but boy, it does. And if one of them is occupying a particularly large amount of memory, then I would do a Google search on the name, the process name, and see what people say, because there are a couple of well-known bugs, and there's a process of fixing them that you can take advantage of. It depends on what it says, but Google search on that. That's what I did, and you'll find it. There's one called, I can't remember the two names. There's a Windows server that gets stuck and just, like, runs wild and uses up memory and just keeps running and running, and that causes beach balling.
Okay.
And the other one is a system stats file that can get extra large. But here's what I would do is before you go to bed, you want to run this activity monitor. You'll find it in the utility folder in applications. And just have it running on the CPU tab. It actually does a graph, so you can see what it was doing overnight. But you just see if there's some process going wild, taking over your system. And even if it's beach balling, you'll see that will be updated.
Okay. Do you think any of those, like the AVG cleaners, where it says clean up my Mac?
Nope. Okay. Neither Windows or Mac, none of those cleanup programs are worth a wooden nickel.
Okay.
They don't help.
One additional question?
Yeah.
You know when you launch a website and it asks you if you want to remember the passwords and everything, and you can select never or...
Never.
Right. Never. I've done that
Good.
To a couple that I've regretted. Is there a way of now...
Yeah.
Going to
Safari settings, you'll see all the passwords. And one of the reasons you don't ever want Safari to remember the passwords is you'll see your passwords. When you go in there, they're hidden by dots, but you can show them. And that means that they're visible. They're not encrypted. Safari, Chrome, Internet Explorer, Firefox, none of them store passwords securely. So I never let the browser remember passwords. You can go in there and delete those. But what I do first is get a program called... You can use 1Password, LastPass, or Dashlane on the Mac. I like LastPass. It's on all platforms. It's $1 a month, $12 a year. But that's only if you want to use it on your mobile device. But what it is a password safe.
Okay.
It will remember your passwords in a secure fashion so that only you can see them. You'll never again have to remember a password. You'll remember one, which is your LastPass password. That's the only password you'll ever need from now on. Make it a good one, but make it something you can remember. And then let it generate good, strong, long, random passwords you'd never in a million years remember, but you don't have to. You can trust LastPass. It is a really reliable way to remember your passwords. And unlike your browser, it's secure.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Yeah. But I think you'll find if you try these few things, first thing I'd do is disconnect that hard drive. This is a known problem on Apple's. In fact, a lot of computers. If you've got a USB drive hooked up, it can cause issues in the long run with your stuff. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number, 888-827-5536. You know what we'll do? We will make this the tip of the week. Josh, would you make a note of that on our... website. What we do at techguylabs.com on a regular basis is we put the weekly tip in there. And the tip of the week this week is going to be how to solve problems with your Macintosh. And I tell you, knowing about this activity monitor, PCs have an activity monitor, process monitor as well. In fact, you can download a really good one if you're using Windows from Microsoft itself. If you look for the sysinternals software, they have a process monitor that's excellent. Sysinternals. It's at Microsoft.com. All right, let's take a break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, our photo guy, coming up next. Mama, don't take my Kodachrome. Mama, don't take... It's time to talk photography with Chris Marquardt, our photo editor from discoverthetopfloor.com. Chris joins us every week to talk about, when he's not on safari, to talk about photography. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
From the beautiful Viewfinder Villa. You had your house warming.
Oh, yes. Oh, we had a house warming. We had about 30 to 40 people here.
Fun.
People brought things to eat and drink, and we had just the greatest time here. It was amazing.
That is awesome. Well, congratulations on the new place. And it's kind of an open studio, and it's a place for photographers. I love that.
It's a place to learn. It's a place to share. It's a place to explore different things. We'll do printing workshops here. We'll do all sorts of interesting things around photography, mostly for the German market, obviously, because it is in Germany. But I'm also planning for some English things here. So it might even be a good idea to stop by when someone travels.
I'm going to be in Germany in July. Now, what town in Germany is it?
It's near Hanover.
Okay.
Which is I know where you are going, so it's not that close to your route.
I'm going down the Rhine and the Main.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, it's going to be beautiful. Then we hit the Danube, little dog leg.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. But Hanover is where the big computer conference CeBIT is every year, so...
Yes, it
maybe
is.
Maybe we'll have to come to CeBIT, and then we can visit the Viewfinder Villa.
Oh, yeah.
So you're
welcome to show up.
Thank you. That's nice of you. Thank you. Myth bust a little bit for us here.
Let's try to bust a photographic myth. The myth is, and you know, every year it happens twice. We have to change the clocks on our cameras, right?
Yes. Although, don't cameras know to do that?
Well, some do, but some don't.
No, I didn't do it. Let me check and see what my Sony says.
See, the thing is, I have pretty much for the last year, I've stopped changing the time on my cameras.
Oh, okay.
Because I keep forgetting, you know, you have to walk around the house, you have to change it on the microwave, you have to go out to your car and change it there, and I just forget, and then
but
I travel, and I'm in a different time zone.
It's a camera's a computer. It should remember.
Yeah. Some of them just don't. So, you know, the thing is, the question first is, why would you want to do it?
Yeah.
Why would you want to do it? Well, the pictures will be in chronological order anyway. So if you sort by time taken, they will still sort in the right order. But there are two cases where it really makes sense to do that. And the first is, this way you can keep two cameras in sync if you shoot with more than one camera. And it might be your smartphone plus your Sony or your Canon or your Nikon bigger camera. And if you want to keep those in sync, it really helps to have the camera set right. Or if you want to geotag your pictures, you want to get geographical information in the pictures where you took them. You know, there are apps that can geolog your position every X seconds. They will kind of write a little log entry, and then later you can use some software to marry those two together, the log and the pictures. That requires the clock to be set. The thing is, you can do this after the fact. And I've started doing this about a year ago. And yeah, if you have something like Lightroom, for example, does it.
Uh-huh.
What I do is I take what I call a reference picture. So while I'm there, while I'm either I travel or I'm somewhere else, I take a picture of a clock on my smartphone.
Okay.
No, so now I have that picture that has, first of all, it's built in time. The camera kind of puts some metadata in there, a timestamp.
Yeah.
Plus, you have the actual time on the picture that you can look at. And that is the actual time. So what Lightroom will let you do is select 500 pictures and then set the reference picture to the time that is actually displayed on the picture.
And adjust
and
the rest?
Lightroom will adjust the rest accordingly. You can also do this on Windows. I think you can do it on Windows Photo Gallery, even though I haven't tried it, but I've read that that's
possible. So it doesn't make everything the same time. It actually adjusts and adds the increment.
It adjusts the delta.
Oh, that's great.
That's what it does. So since then, what I do is I take that reference picture, which with each of my cameras, so I have like two DSLRs with me. I take a reference picture with both of them. Doesn't have to be at the same time. And then I go in and I select all of the pictures for that camera. I make the main selection, that reference picture, and then I just go in there and...
That is awesome.
And tell it to set it to that time. And it's super simple. I've actually written about it on my blog. If you go to tipsfromthetopfloor.com, there's an article about it that explains it. And yes, You will read in the comments that there are other methods to do it, and everyone has
their
favorite
this method.
But now this one works really well for me.
I, on my Sony, do have a daylight savings time setting, so it actually, the time is accurate. It adjusted it for daylight savings time here. But you still might want to do that because the clocks and cameras, unlike your computer, don't set themselves automatically in most cases, unless you have a GPS built into the
atomic
time.
And they might drift a bit.
So they drift. So it's a good idea to do this so you have an accurate starting point. And you can adjust, even if it's only a few minutes, it might be worth doing that, especially if you need it for an alibi.
If you work with the geologger, if you want to like really accurate places that you took the pictures with, and if your camera doesn't have GPS, that's one of the ways to do it. You want the time to be reasonably accurate within a few seconds. That really helps do that.
I'm going to do it right now. You know, there's other things you might want to put into your camera, like your name and address. What do you take? Take a picture of your name and address the first time you use your memory card and things like that, right?
Some cameras let you do that, like set it up in camera, so it puts it into the IPTC data, which is a part of the metadata of a picture. Some software lets you do it, like Lightroom. As soon as you import a picture, you can pretty much put that metadata stamp onto your picture, so it'll automatically have your name and your address and everything in there. So whenever you export a picture out and give it to someone else, they will have that information as well.
You know, now that I know that I can use Lightroom to adjust the time in the, it's stored in the EXIF information of every photo. Maybe I should just set my camera to UTC to Greenwich
Mean Time.
Some
people do that.
And then I can always adjust it, right?
And then you don't even need the reference picture, but then you need to do math. With my method, you don't have to do math, you know?
Math is hard.
Math is hard, yeah.
Oh, I don't want to do any math. No, there is a good reason to have the accurate time and date in there. I don't usually mind if it's off by an hour, but if for some reason, geolocation, for instance, you do.
Oh, geolocation, or you want a chronological sort, all the pictures from your Sony camera and your smartphone.
That's a good point.
If you want them cameras, together, then you will have to have the right time. Otherwise, that doesn't work.
Now, you could do that without taking a picture. If you are taking a camera phone shot at the same time, because the camera phone's always going to reflect the accurate time, right?
True, because they set themselves.
So as long as you're taking some camera phone pictures, you know those are accurate. You could adjust pictures taken at the same time together. That would be another way to do it.
Yeah. But then all you have to do is, again, take the reference picture off the screen of your smartphone with an accurate clock on there. And then you have it on your other camera as well, and then you can adjust it.
You're brilliant. He's Chris Marquardt. He is a photographer, but also a great teacher and podcaster. His podcast is called Tips from the Top Floor. But you also can take his workshops. You'll find them all, podcasts, workshops, and everything else at discoverthetopfloor.com. Now, we have an assignment. I don't want you to forget that. What is our topic, our suggestion this week?
Asleep.
Just asleep. Okay.
Just asleep.
So you have another week or so. I think it's a week, right? We're going to do it next week.
Next week we do that, yes.
So you have a week now to take a picture. Could be with a camera phone. Doesn't have to be with a fancy camera. Anything. But take a picture illustrating asleep. That could be a lot of different things. Could be a picture of the United States Congress. I mean, there's, you know, anything that reflects the word asleep, you could have that. And then what the trick is, though, you got to be join Flickr. If you're not already a Yahoo user, you'll find it at flickr.com. And that's free, no charge. You can store your pictures there. I love it. It's a great photo sharing site. And we have a tech guy group there. So you'll need to put asleep in the tag of the picture and submit it to our tech guy group. Renee Silverman is waiting for you. And we will wait for you, Chris Marquardt, to join us again next week. Thanks for being here. Happy Easter. And are you celebrating? Did you hide some Easter? Do they do that in Germany? Hide Easter
eggs? No, we just get some time off, so.
Good enough. Thanks, Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. We got sunshine songs all day today. Thanks to Nathan Staten, our musical director. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Todd in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hi, Todd.
Oh, Leo, how are you doing today?
I am awesome. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to talk to you. I'm a professional photographer, and in my studio, I have monitors all around me, and one of them is dedicated to the TWiT network. And you run, every time I'm in my studio for hours, I just get to sit here and listen to your network, and I just love it.
Todd, I am so flattered. Thank you. Thank you.
Got some questions for you. One of the things that I do as a photographer, first of all, I'm a fire photographer. I work for fire departments.
Oh, I love that.
It's neat. I get to see a lot of neat things and sometimes a little bit, you know, gross, but, you know, it is what it is.
Well, you're going to disasters. Yeah. But on the other hand, I have another friend who is a fire photographer, former police officer, does it for fun, not professionally. But because he's a former police officer, fire departments often welcome him across the line. And boy, it is amazing. Now, he's careful about what cameras he uses because there's a lot of heat. You don't want to bring a great camera in there because it's not good for him.
Yeah, I've melted several lenses.
Wow. Wow.
Generally, I don't get in there, but every once in a while, you'll get into that. Anyway, the other thing that I do is I'm a storm chaser. And
you like dramatic photography.
my wife just loves it. And what's happened in storm chasing over the years is that we've gone from being able to photograph what we see to now we can literally stream what we see online, and not only can people watch what we're doing, but we can send it to the National Weather Service so they can see what we're seeing in real time.
Wow, that's neat.
It's neat stuff. And as you know, like Meerkat and all those other things that are out there allow you to do things in places that you never could before.
Now, of course, cautions. We should just a little disclaimer here. You're a professional. You work with fire departments. This is not something that you should get. You don't want to get in the way of emergency first responders. Do not slow this process down. I know, because you know what you're doing, but I think people will say, oh, that sounds like a good idea, and then you're going to – it's disaster.
Well, yeah, and the public safety stuff I do is totally opposite what I do with the Weather Service.
Yeah. And don't go chasing storms either. Go the other way.
My problem is that in the old days, now when I say old, I only mean like a few years ago, we had to keep PCs in our vehicles. And what we would do is we would, you know, hotspot our phones or whatever. Wow. And we used to have to use Adobe encoder or flash encoder so that the cameras on our trucks could record things and get it into the PC.
Right.
Well, what's happened is now we can stream using our cell phones or our tablets, but we can't, at least I haven't figured out, and that's my question, is how can I get the remote cameras that are on the top of my vehicle to talk to my Android tablets so that I can stream what they see? And then we're not talking 1080p here. We're only talking, you know, 720 because we're streaming.
Yeah.
But I don't want to hold my phone out the window while I'm driving. I'd like to be able to, is there an adapter or something or some way I can get this video information into these tablets that I can stream it?
Yeah, I mean, you know that we can do that with drones, of course. The drone, like the Bebop drone or the DJI Phantom, have cameras on them and communicate back, usually using Wi-Fi, communicate back to the base unit, and so you can use a tablet as a viewfinder. And you need that on a drone because you're moving around. You don't know what you're taking pictures of. I would guess that there are, and I'm going to have to ask the chat room and maybe Chris Marquardt if he's still listening, Wi-Fi adapters for cameras that will do the same thing. A lot of photographers shoot tethered in the studio. You probably do.
Right. Yes.
But that's a hard wire. You tether it back to Lightroom or something like that, and then that way, if you're doing a photo shoot for an agency, the agency can look at the photo, make changes while you're working. It's a great setup. To do that out wirelessly out in the real world, interesting. I know that some cameras do have Wi-Fi built in. Sony's, for instance. I use the Sony Alpha series, the A7s. Those all have Wi-Fi, and I can use Sony's Play Memories app to see the output of the camera, to even control it. So I could set up
Some of these cameras that we're using they put out a video composite feed, you know, that you can grab. And the reason we have to use these cameras is, like, the ones that are on the top of my vehicle are bulletproof because they get hit with hail and every implement you can think that gets...
You're not using GoPros, because, of course, that's how a GoPro works as well.
Yeah, and I've played with the GoPros. They're fun. They are a lot.
Yeah, GoPro's the same thing. It creates... What it does is it creates an ad hoc, we were talking about this earlier, ad hoc Wi-Fi network, which you join. So you'll take your smartphone and you'll search for Wi-Fi signals, and you'll see GoPro A39712. You'll join it, and now you're getting a Wi-Fi signal from the camera. They don't use Bluetooth because it's not fast enough. There's not enough bandwidth. Yeah. But Wi-Fi will work. I would guess that you could get a Wi-Fi adapter that would connect to the composite output. If your camera sends live video out while it's shooting, I presume it does, right?
Yeah.
You need a some sort of Wi-Fi. If you're and the camera itself doesn't have Wi-Fi built in, as the Sonys and the GoPros do, then you'd need
not
some
ones that we can afford.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, and you certainly don't want to put a Sony Alpha on your roof.
You know, I love those cameras. They are fantastic.
Oh, they're amazing. Yeah.
All my equipment is Canon and, you know, big expensive lenses, but I saw your review on it and everything I've heard about those little Sonys is just amazing.
Well, and I wouldn't take it near a fire either, frankly.
No, but it'd be a lot easier to carry.
Here's something that the chat room is telling me about from a company called WatchGuard Video. It's called Watch Commander. Live video streaming software. Now, I don't know. You need to have. This is actually is used by police agencies.
Mm-hmm.
But I it uses built-in hardware, and that's the problem because you need to have the hardware in your camera to begin with. I think there's got to be something. That will attach, an adapter that will attach. It'll give you Wi-Fi on your camera. I'm going to trust the chat room one more time and see if DSL...
Yeah, I'm watching the chat room.
Yeah, they're throwing out answers that aren't really the ones that work. Yeah, this is the DSLR controller is not the solution. This is a USB cable. So they're not paying close attention. I will look. We'll find something. What you need is a wireless device that would hook up to the outputs of your camera. What kind of outputs does this particular camera have?
The ones that I have up are just straight composite. Just
composite
normal.
Out. Okay, so that's the yellow jack.
Right.
So you need a composite to some sort of Wi-Fi, which also would be small because it's going to be a transmitter, which you could then in the car or the truck pick up with your Android and then be able to see it. I'm not sure. I'm going to have to take a look.
A couple people asking for my website. Can I give it?
Yeah, why not? I love it.
All the photos that I take of the fire departments and the weather, after they're done with them, you know, we use them for arson and things like that. They're cleared, and then I put them on a website, and that's where the firefighters can go, and they can look at themselves. And I give everything away for free. They're all welcome to the photos. And anyway, the website's phototac.com. It's P-H-O-T-O. T is in Tom. A is in Apple. C is in Cat. And
Todd F. Parker, photographer?
Yep.
That's you? All right. Yep. Oh, look at these. Oh, my goodness.
When I'm not doing all that, I'm shooting senior photos and families just like a normal photographer.
Yeah, you have to, but you have to have your art, don't you?
Yes.
It's so hard to be a working photographer because you have to make a living.
It's changed so dramatically. I worked for the newspaper for several years, and they laid off most of the photographers, so I had to find another way like most photographers do.
Didn't the Chicago Tribune do that? They laid off all their photographers, and they said they gave their reporters camera phones.
Yep,
and said,
that's
that'll do.
Yeah. Most of the photographers that work for the paper now all carry iPhones.
Oh, that's so depressing.
They take with the exception of like sporting events and things like that. But they shoot it in the field and then they get it to the paper within minutes. So,
well, Todd, I love your photography. It's gorgeous.
Well, thank you.
Phototac, phototac.com, and you can see his photography, and it's just gorgeous stuff. Really neat stuff. I'll tell you what, we will find it. We'll put it in the show notes. And if you have some ideas for a Wi-Fi device you could hook up to a camera in a kind of a tough environmental situation, so it'd need to be pretty robust, and that would broadcast back into the cab of the truck. You certainly could build something like that with the Raspberry Pi, as Burke's telling me, but let's see if we could find a commercial. There must be a product out there that does that. I can't believe there isn't. All the tethering stuff for studios, though, uses USB or some other hardwired connection. That's not going to do it for us. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Well, hey, hey, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, of course, smartphones. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. 888-827-5536. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada. Our website, free, no sign up, wide open. I have to say that because there are sites that charge. I don't know why. You know what? We have wonderful sponsors that pay for everything you hear, so you don't pay a penny. It's free. TechGuyLabs.com. And all the shows are there. Show notes in text, so you can quickly find a link or whatever. But also audio and video from shows, from past shows. And you can drill down by day, by hour, by even by caller, and make comments, too. So, if, for instance, our last caller, who has a really interesting job, he's a professional photographer, but his hobby is chasing storms and going to fires and taking pictures. They're very dramatic pictures. But he'd like, what he'd like for his storm chasing vehicle is a, he's got a bulletproof, weatherproof camera that he puts on the top there, but he'd like to control the camera, see the output of the camera on a tablet safe inside the cab of the truck. So he needs some sort of wireless way to see what the camera is displaying in the truck. And I told him, get a GoPro, because that's exactly what GoPros do. Well, we love the GoPro. I have several of them. We were using them the other day. We were riding Segways around. Those are those little scooters, two-wheeled scooters. And we put GoPros. One guy was wearing it on his forehead. I had one on my wheel. And then you just pull out your smartphone, and you can see the image being, you know, the live video from the GoPro. So you know exactly what you're getting. I love that. But I guess the GoPros are not as weather resistant. I think, you know, they have waterproof housings. I would think you could put a GoPro in a housing and it would be pretty safe. Anyway, 8888 Ask Leo. But if you go to the website techguylabs.com and you have a good solution for our caller, for Todd and his photography, that'd be the place to put it in the comments there. Back to the phones we go to Manhattan Beach. Jane is on the line. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I've got the problem is a cursor jams and freezes up. What I have is a Toshiba Tekra.
I love how you say it jams, like a typewriter, like there's something physical getting stuck.
Well, it sure...
It feels like that, I'm sure. So the cursor is either your mouse pointer, or when you're in text, it turns into that I bar. That's what you're talking about?
It's the arrow that gets stuck.
Yeah, but and when you're saying it gets stuck, you mean it stops moving.
It stops moving.
It's not actually stuck because there's not. It's just pixels on a screen. So you move your mouse, but nothing happens on the screen.
I use a touchpad. Yes.
Okay. You move your trackpad. You move your finger on the trackpad, but nothing happens on the screen.
Correct.
Yeah, but is the computer still operating? Is the clock changing time or things happening on the computer?
Yes.
So it's just that the mouse has stopped moving.
Yes.
If you type with your keyboard, will the letters appear?
Good question. I am so focused on that little arrow. I think it would.
Here's why I ask.
Yes.
So it is a laptop, obviously, because you have a trackpad, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I guess people could use a trackpad on the desktop, but most people, they use them on a laptop. So if you can still type, then not only is the computer alive, but the USB connection's working, all of that's working. But if the mouse pad stops working and the keyboard stops working, that's one kind of problem versus just the mouse pad not working. Now, just the trackpad not working could be a physical failure of the trackpad. How do you get it to work again?
The little dot joystick in the middle of the keyboard, if I press that, it will unstick it and move it again.
Interesting.
Trackpad.
So you have a Lenovo.
Yes.
With a little track point, please forgive me, but the little nipple that's in there in the keyboard.
Uh-huh.
And that still works.
It's a Toshiba.
Oh, Toshiba also uses those. That's right. You said Toshiba. A Tekra. I love those Tekras. It's kind of old, though, now.
I got it about 6 months ago.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought they'd stopped making Tekras. Well, that's good. Did you get it new?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So that's great input. You just told me that the little track point, that little eraser nub there does work. In fact, when you do it and kind of unstick the cursor, it all works again.
Yes, and I just poke it once. I do not use it any other time, but that's what I found.
Isn't that interesting? So here's what I think is going on, and then this is a little technical. You have some schmutz on your trackpad.
Okay.
That's the tech schmutz. Because what's happening, and sometimes this actually can happen with static electricity as well, the trackpad gets unresponsive, and sometimes this actually works. I'm not going to recommend it, but I've been told, and I have done this. If you take an eraser and you go on the trackpad real fast, sometimes that will fix it permanently, because there's like it's like something going on with the trackpad, like there's just little debris in there, or sometimes it's static electricity. And the fact that you can get the cursor to move again tells me it's a trackpad flaw, not a software problem, not a computer problem, but a trackpad hardware issue. You could also, since it's only 6 months old, it's under warranty. You could say, hey, fix this. But if you want to try, somebody's suggesting, and I know this would the answer to this question. But if you had a USB mouse and you plugged it in, you would also be able to move the cursor, I believe, and that's because that's what the track point is doing. That little nubby there, it's just like a mouse. So it's just we've isolated it. It's the trackpad.
Could you comment on this?
Where do I go? What do I do? Well, like I said, you might take some gentle cleaner and put it. Don't put it directly on the trackpad, because moisture is actually a bad thing for a trackpad. But take a soft rag and moisten it with some Windex or some of that green cleaner, something gentle, and clean not only the whole trackpad, but get in the edges there of the trackpad. Is it one of those trackpads that you press it in and it clicks?
Yes.
Yeah. I got one other thing. Oh. Dummy. I'm a dummy. Your Toshiba also has something very smart. It disables the trackpad while you type. And that's so you won't accidentally do stuff while you're typing, because guess where your wrists are sitting? Right near that trackpad. So look, you may have a control panel that disables the trackpad during typing, and you also have a key on your Toshiba, a physical key that disables the trackpad. You may be hitting that. So that's what, chat room, thank you. I think that's probably what's happening. I would clean the trackpad carefully. Don't get it too wet. Mm-hmm. I would also make sure you don't, do you get a lot of static in Manhattan Beach? Probably not.
No.
Nope. Humidity's pretty good.
No, it is dry with low rain. Very.
Yeah. No. So static can also do that to a trackpad, make it fail briefly. But I bet you anything you have, look in your control panel. It'll be in the mouse control panel or the trackpad control panel. There's a setting that says disable trackpad during typing or something like it. And that's intentional. That's so you won't nudge the cursor while you're typing, but it sounds like it's not working right. So turn that off.
Okay.
And you should also find, and it'll be in your Toshiba documentation. I know they give you a pamphlet, but somewhere
a very small pamphlet,
but maybe you could find it online if you can't find it in the pamphlet. There is a key on your keyboard that will disable the trackpad. You may be accidentally hitting that.
I will check on that also. I have a question.
Okay.
Here.
If you do, hang on, because we've got the magic music that tells me all the radio stations are going to stop listening in a moment. So hang on. We'll go back and answer your second question when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're talking to Jane in Manhattan Beach, California. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for being there again.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you heard during the break, but if you have a Synaptics mouse pad, they call it Palm Check. Go into those settings. It's under your mouse settings. And if you can, you can change the settings on Palm Check. That's probably what's going on. What's question number two?
This is related. And if someone could clarify this for me, because I'm not quite sure I understand it. That the cursor or controller in Toshiba computers is often assigned a delay in performance whenever a key is struck. That often confuses the program as an unexpected delay inserts itself in the predicted software timeline.
Where are you reading this from? Is this something you wrote down or?
It was something I wrote down from something that I found.
Ah,
trying to understand it better.
Yeah.
As far as this delay.
So tell me what you're experiencing. You're seeing that you'll type something and you don't see the key, the letter pop up right away?
No, I have some sophisticated software, and I use the cursor, the clicker, to choose what next I want to have happen.
Yeah.
And in doing that, that's when it will freeze up. I'll be moving the cursor.
Oh, so you think this is somehow related to what the delay that it's introduced? Yeah, no, I don't think that's it. I think there's something else going on.
So, something else.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So don't worry about that. When you're writing along, it keeps up with you, right?
That it does.
Okay,
although
good.
I use it not for composing documents. I use it mostly for this software that I click.
Some sort of specialized software that you are using.
Yes.
Okay. And the idea of the software is you need to click the mouse on a selection?
Yes.
And you click it, and nothing happens, or the mouse stops moving?
Usually things do happen that I want.
Oh, good.
When I go to the button and press it, and it does nothing.
You can't click.
Right. Yes.
Can I ask you what this software is?
It's an SRC biofeedback type.
Ah, got it. Okay.
Yes.
Interesting. It could be this is the software doing its thing. It could be the software is not super well written and it's not responding. You know, what software does behind the scenes is kind of what we call an event loop. It just sits there going, until you do something. And then so one of the things you can do is move a mouse over something. And sometimes you'll notice that'll change how the mouse looks. Sometimes one of the things you can do is what they call mouse down or button down, because you've clicked the mouse. And then there's a button up event. And the software is just sitting there waiting for these little events. I see a mouse down. Oh, go do something. If it doesn't see the mouse down or it's busy doing something else, it won't respond. So I have a feeling it just may be software that's not super well written. I don't think it's your machine. I would go into control panels. It's in the hardware section of your control panels, and there's something called mouse, and there's all sorts of settings in there. And it may be that your mouse is set funny. So I would look at those settings, because it sounds like there's something going on with the mouse, with the and when I say mouse, by the way, in your case, it's a trackpad, obviously. But there's something going on with the trackpad. The trackpad and the mouse are different expressions of the same device. So a mouse down is the same thing as clicking the trackpad, pressing it in. A mouse up is the same thing as releasing it. Moving the mouse is just moving your finger on the trackpad. But I think if you go to the mouse settings, look at that. And then within the mouse settings, there should be trackpad settings. If it's a Synaptics trackpad, which I think it is, it'll say Synaptics. Go in there and play with those settings. I think that's likely something what's going on. It may be, though, that the software itself is not responsive. It's up to the software to be responsive. If you don't notice this kind of behavior on the web doing anything else, then it's probably the software. Alan is in Simi Valley. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Alan.
Hey, how's it going? Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Two questions concerning Windows 7 versus 8.1. The big question is, I'm having somebody build a computer for me. I don't like the look of 8.1. Is there really a major advantage of 7 versus 8.1?
Well, yes and no. I mean, every new version of Windows fixes problems with the previous versions, usually is more secure, et cetera, et cetera. As you know, Microsoft made a very difficult decision in the transition from 7 to 8.1, or actually to 8, and then 8.1 is fixing some of it, which is that Microsoft decided that tablets were the next big thing, and they wanted Windows to work equally well on a desktop computer and a tablet. The way they solved this was completely screwy. They basically put two operating systems in one, a tablet operating system with big buttons and lots of finger gestures to do things, and they mixed that in with your Windows 7-style desktop operating system. And that's where most of the dislike comes from, is it's confusing. What am I on a tablet? Am I on a desktop? Why are there two versions of Internet Explorer, one for tablet, one for desktop, and you don't know which one's going to launch, and the two versions of the control panel? All things crazy. It's two operating systems just kind of willy-nilly mushed together. So here's my advice. Get Windows 7. You like it. You're comfortable with it. Microsoft has announced that when Windows 10 comes out, which is the next edition of Windows, and it's due out this summer, whatever that means, they will give you a free upgrade to Windows 10.
Oh, okay, if I buy 7.
So get 7, install 7, you like 7, you're used to it. It's a desktop operating system without any tablet stuff in there at all. I've been playing with the pre-release of 10. I believe 10 is going to make a lot of people feel better.
Okay.
So I think 10 is going to fix the problems of 8 and 8.1. But you don't have to decide now. Get 7, and when 10 comes out, look at it. And you may say, I'm still going to stick with 7. You do usually want the upgrades because they fix things. They make it better. For instance, Windows 8 fixed a problem that's been part of Windows since Windows 95, just the world's worst file copy routines. They're terrible. They're slow. They break. They're just unusable. They finally fixed it in Windows 8. That's a good reason to upgrade, but there's not enough reason to go through the pain. So get 7, get 10 when it comes out.
Okay, related quick question here. My wife is running applications that will not take Windows 8 or 8.1. Windows 7.
Okay.
CS5. Are there laptops out there that still have 7?
You can find them if you look, but Microsoft sunset. On Halloween of last year, Microsoft sunsetted Windows 7 and said to computer manufacturers, you can no longer ship with Windows 7. So if you find one, it'll be an older laptop that was made and shipped to the retailer before Halloween of last year. You can still buy Windows 7, and that may be the solution for you. I would say you need to find better apps. If an app will work with 7 and not 8, then the people who make the app obviously are kind of not paying attention. They need to get with the program. But meanwhile, stick with Windows 7. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Grazing in the grass. It's gas. Steve in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
Hey, I'm great, Steve. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I called to give a review of the HP Stream laptop.
Oh, this is an amazing laptop. Well, how much did you pay for it?
I bought mine at Best Buy, so I paid a little more.
What?
I bought a 64-gig micro SD card. I don't know, it was like $299,
okay,
I think.
This is a Windows 8.1 laptop for $299.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, I had a more basic one for $230. I think they sell, now you can get Windows 8 laptops for $150. I mean, they've really dropped the prices on these. So what do you think of the Stream? First of all, what color did you get?
Oh, I don't even know. I'm blind, so I couldn't.
You didn't care. Well, actually, I'd love to get a review on how accessibility is on that.
Oh, it's great. It runs the screen, both NVDA and JAWS. It runs great on it. It's fast.
Isn't that amazing?
It is, and there's no fan either, not that I can tell.
No, probably not. It's an Atom processor. They don't take a lot of. They don't make a lot of
heat. No, it's just only the front left corner on the bottom gets a little warm, but it's. I got the 13-inch version. Of course, they sell an 11-inch version.
Yep.
And my only beef would be is it's 32 gigs, and you're only allowed anywhere from 12 to 15 gigs free storage after everything, right. But you can uninstall stuff. And that's what I would recommend to anybody that got it, is in the add-remove program, because you know HP, they like to put the crust on the computer.
Yeah, uninstall, because you don't have that much storage to begin with, so it's really important to uninstall all that stuff.
Yeah, and they have McAfee is the first thing I got rid of.
Good.
And then they had something called 7-Zip, it's some kind of adware thing, because all of a sudden it popped up one day with an ad for Dropbox or something. Got rid of the 7-Zip thing, and believe it or not, there's HP registration and HP support were buggy. They crashed.
Yeah, I believe that.
And I'm like, I don't need either of those, so I haven't installed those.
I'd like to report a problem to HP support. HP support software crashes.
It crashed? Yeah, exactly. It, you don't need that. And it set up the machine. It boots up with the HP support registration and that 7-zip gone. The thing boots up remarkably fast.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I reviewed an HP Stream myself. They come in colors. I think I had a blue one and was very impressed for the price. You're getting a great little laptop. Now, if you can afford more, you get more with, you know, more speed and so forth. But, boy, if all you have is a couple hundred bucks, this is a great...
Yeah, I think it's $279 is what I paid.
Yeah, for a student, for a kid, this is a great... Or for a second computer, this is a great choice.
It is, right. Now, the difference is there's the HP Stream tablet. Now, that's a different story. That you don't want to mess with. That had some... limited edition version of Windows 8.
And yeah.
Certain software.
They call that Windows with Bing.
Yeah.
That's the free version.
Yeah, that thing, I would not recommend that at all. But the Stream laptop is beautiful. I mean, it's a wonderful machine.
Well, I appreciate the unsolicited testimonial. That's good to know.
Yeah, we've been, my girlfriend and I have been working on them for last couple of days, and it's like, hey, this is great. I mean,
very nice. Very nice.
It works really
and I'm well, glad to hear that you can use your voiceover software.
Exactly.
And it's got enough horsepower, enough oomph to run it. That's really good news.
It runs both NVDA and JAWS perfect. So, yeah, exactly. That new Atom processor is amazing.
Yeah. You know, I mean, if you think about it, even the low and slow, inexpensive processors of today are running laps around the processors of 5 years ago. So... It's silly to say, oh, I would never use an Atom. Well, but it's 10 times faster than the 2010 laptop you're using.
In some ways, this thing's faster than my old Pentium 4.
Oh, it is. It should be faster than a Pentium 4.
And I was like, wow, it blows me away. And fan, no moving hard drive.
I love that.
I got the micro SD card, so it would hold the to put my data on, because obviously I have limited. I think I have like 12 gigs of free space on the.
Well, that's something to be aware of. And these are to compete with, and thank Microsoft to some degree, because they've made this possible by giving away Windows or very low cost Windows. They're really trying to get to compete with Chromebooks, frankly, which are at this low price point. And that's what this is competition for. This is competition for a $200 to $250 Chromebook, but instead you get full Windows. What you don't get is a lot of storage on either platform, because they expect you to store stuff on OneDrive, you know, in the cloud, not on the hard drive. But if you're using Microsoft Office, and in many cases he's come with a free year of Microsoft Office, if you're using Microsoft Office, you can save documents locally, but more likely you're going to save them on OneDrive. Hey, thanks for the unsolicited testimonial. I appreciate that, Steve. Albert, Henderson, Nevada.
Leo.
Bad news, Albert.
I was afraid you're going to say that.
So, Heather said you have a Moto X. Love the phone.
I love the phone.
Yeah. Doesn't come with Flash. And
nope.
Adobe has stopped making mobile Flash. So, but this started with Apple. Remember, Apple would not put Flash on iOS. Neither an iPhone nor an iPad has Flash.
Right.
And the reason is it's big, it's bad, it's buggy. And what's happened in many cases, but not all, unfortunately, is that sites have... abandoned Flash for other better ways to animate, to play back video. Unfortunately, it's not all sites.
Is there anything I can get to put Flash on the phone?
Yeah, there are. There are like browsers that have Flash built in and stuff. What is it that you want to do?
Well, I go to a couple of websites quite often that show a lot of video.
Yeah.
And I want to do it at work on my phone when I'm on break and stuff, and I can't do it.
There's like Flash Fox for Android. There are third-party, and this is probably the only way I'd recommend it, third-party browsers that will do this. The Tunny browser, T-U-N-N-Y, and they basically come with Flash wrapped into the browser. I think it's a terrible idea.
I know, you don't like Flash.
I don't like Flash, and what we need to do is push these sites to stop trying to sneak Flash on. But this is the solution. Puffin browser, the chat room's telling me, also has Flash built in. Puffin. So Puffin, Tunny, T-U-N-N-Y, and Flash Fox. I haven't tried any of them, but the chat room's saying these all three will allow you to go to sites that have Flash. What we got to do... is encourage these sites to not use Flash. Now, I'm an offender, by the way, because if you go to watch our streams, we use companies like Ustream for video streaming, and Ustream does it in Flash. I don't have a choice. We want to make sure that everybody who wants to watch the video of our shows can watch it. So we actually pay for a non-Flash video server for people who are using iOS or Roku or other devices that don't do Flash. And I think increasingly that's what you're going to see. Even YouTube has abandoned Flash. Flash is dying, just not dying fast enough. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thank you, Nathan Staten, doing a great job with upbeat, positive music today. Gary is next in Panama City, Florida. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how you doing, Leo?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. I'm actually in a little town outside of Panama City called Apalachicola. Kind of hard to say.
I love it. Apalachicola. Sounds great.
Yeah, it's kind of small and rural. And
you have gators out there?
Oh, my God, everywhere, on the golf course, in the creeks, and big ones. We saw like a 10-footer in the pond next to our golf course recently.
Okay. I'm getting the picture. Okay, go ahead.
Not a very good hazard. But I'm about 4 miles outside of town, and I'm on kind of like a temporary location, so I can't get Wi-Fi there. I've got a 6, I've got an iPad, I've got 10 gigs a month with Verizon. You know, they took my unlimited away. I'm very upset about that.
Yep.
But anyway, I'm trying to find a way to get Wi-Fi out here, like on a month, something not so outrageous, whether it be a portable.
So what you're going to look for, so you there's a few ways to get internet out there. What you're doing is what a lot of people do, which is using the cell networks, using LTE to get your Wi-Fi. Unfortunately, it's expensive, and most of the carriers now cap you. And 10 gigs is not a lot for a month for your full allocation. There are other choices. You can look for a WISP, a wireless internet service provider. Some of them use microwaves if you're in line of sight. Some of them can be quite fast and quite affordable, but I don't know if there's one in Apalachicola or not. You just have to look. So you're looking for a WISP.
Online, but,
then the third way, well, I'll tell you where to go, broadbandreports.com.
Okay, Broadband Reports.
You can enter your zip code. I love Broadband Reports. It's an independent site. It's been around for years. It used to be DSL Reports, but then they made it Broadband Reports. You'll find this on the website. You don't have to write it down. TechGuyLabs.com.
Okay.
But Broadband Reports, you can enter your zip code, and then what's nice is you'll see other people in the area with reviews. Now, you're in a tiny area, so there may not be any reviews, but at least you should be able to see what's available. The final choice, of course, is satellite.
Right.
Satellite has its own issues. It can be expensive, depending on whether they make you buy the gear or not, because you have to get a satellite, a small dish, you know, kind of like a DirecTV dish. And you also will have bandwidth caps, but often not as bad. Speed can be an issue, but more latency, because it takes a while for your signal to get to the satellite, bounce back down to the Earth, and vice versa. So it's not great for Skype or gaming, you know, first-person shooters. But it's good for internet and email. My recommendation there is Wild Blue from Exceed.
Okay.
Just Google Wild Blue. They're very good. They have very high speed. It's not going to be cheap. And somebody told me who has Wild Blue that he did not have to pay for equipment, which would be very nice.
So they go unlimited, or is that in whatever?
I bet you get unlimited if you pay enough. You know, what's been a problem in the past was with Direct TV. They have a system, but the problem with it is they had something called a fair usage policy. If you you started using a lot of bandwidth, they'd get you way down because
throttle you down.
There's limited bandwidth available to the satellite itself.
I see.
Yeah,
and it's way out there as well.
Yeah. So, but I would check with Wild Blue. People I know who use Wild Blue have get great results. We've used it every year. In fact, we're going to do it in a couple of weeks. We go to Dayton, Ohio, for the Ham Convention, Hamvention in Dayton, and our hams who are out there, they have a booth. We'll call in via Wild Blue, and it's really amazing. The quality is fantastic. So it is, and that's Skype. So I think Wild Blue is pretty good. But those will be your choices: satellite, wireless internet service provider. Typically, they'll use microwave. Sometimes they'll use WiMAX or other Wi-Fi technologies. And then LTE, which you're already using. And those are the negatives on each.
Well, I hope they're wild blue because we have 10,000 people in our county and one traffic light. We're rural.
Well, and that, you know, it's a big issue. In fact, the FCC has taken this on because increasingly access to internet is more important. It's not a luxury. It's how you participate in our economy. It's how you learn, how you educate yourself. And the FCC has really decided that this should be this way. And I think this is the only way to do it. No enterprise is going to do it. There's not enough money to be made. There's too few people. It's what we did with the rural electrification projects back during the Depression, things like the Tennessee Valley Authority. Those are designed to bring electricity to rural areas. The private companies would never have done it. It's just not profitable enough. We're going to have to do the same thing with internet. And I believe that is the plan. But we'll have to see when they put some money into it. But I think they plan to spend billions of dollars to do that. The next thing to look to is your local government. See if you can get them to buy wholesale bandwidth and become an internet service provider, a municipal internet service provider. That's a good solution.
Yeah.
Start a co-op, in fact. Okay? Good luck.
All right. Well, happy Easter. Thanks a lot.
Watch the alligator. Watch for the gators. Our last call of the day. Tamar on the line from Los Angeles. Hi, Tamar.
Leo, I'm so glad you got to me. You know, iHeartRadio has stopped working on my OS 10.9.5, but on my computer right next to it, which is 10.5.8, it does work. And I've been on the phone with AppleCare a couple of days in a row. They tried to troubleshoot and screen share.
Slow down. So this is great. I love iHeartRadio. It is an app created by the company that owns the show, so I have to love it. And they have a website, but they also have apps. Tell me about how you're doing this. Is it an iPad? Is it an iPhone?
I'm on my MacBook Pro.
You're on a Macintosh computer, and that's the one that doesn't work?
Well, they're both MacBook Pros. It does work on 10.5.8, but it doesn't work on 10.9.5.
Oh, I see. You're saying the latest version of the operating system. Not even the latest.
Right. But you know what? I wanted to say that this woman at AppleCare, and they took me to an upper-level AppleCare person, and she shared my screen, you know. She said she couldn't get it to work. She went home on her own computer, and it didn't work on her computer at home. She was getting the same errors, like it just wouldn't load.
Are you going to the website iHeartRadio?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I'm going to the website.
Okay.
And she said she went back yesterday morning to AppleCare, the office that she works in, and she tried it on 10.7, 10.8, 10.9, and 10.10, and apparently it's broken on all of them. She couldn't get iHeartRadio to broadcast on any of those computers at AppleCare. So she says she thinks that recently Safari's had an update. And although I tried it on five browsers, I have five different browsers, it didn't work on any of them, and she did.
Okay, stop talking so fast, because I can't get a word in edgewise.
Okay.
Use Google Chrome as your browser. Stop using Safari. They stopped.
We tried it. We both tried.
Doesn't work with Chrome?
It doesn't work.
Because they stopped putting, what happened is they stopped putting Flash on Macintoshes, and iHeartRadio uses Flash.
Well, we both, she said, let's try Chrome because that doesn't use Flash. She had me update Flash Player, all the browsers.
Okay, and it doesn't work in Chrome either.
She said.
I have to cut you off. I'm sorry, because we only have a few seconds left. Let me look into it and see what I can find out for you. It's working right now on my 10.10 Macintosh, so I'm not sure exactly. I would guess it is a Flash issue. I'm surprised Chrome doesn't work. Maybe Chrome has Flash disabled. Sounds like iHeartRadio is the problem. So I better talk to the boss, huh? Hey, thanks for the call. Thank you for listening. Hope you had a great time. We'll see you next week. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.